Hello and welcome to One Inch Past Scary Podcast. I'm Kirsty Sayer. I'm here with my really good friend, J.R. Ratliff. J.R., you have another name. I just never think of you as Jason, but Jason Ratliff.
Yeah, and totally. I joke with my friends and say, only my good friends know my government name. So, so you my people, Kirsty. No, no, I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
JR is probably in the top, like, I can't actually say, I don't want to give numbers, but he's super high. And the coolest people I know, because then other people are going to start doing process of elimination and then it could leave some folks.
I'm glad I'm in the top end of this list.
You're very high on the scale. And JR gave me my very cool Monica Casey, which I keep trying to make happen. But
yeah,
I can't get it to happen. Only you can make it happen, JR. Okay.
Well, Casey, we're going to make it happen today.
We're going to make it happen. We're going to have liftoff on this thing. Yeah. So, JR is actually in Dubai. What's the weather like today?
Today was nice. Today, I think, was about 74-ish, the high. Yeah. So, these are the good months, actually. These are the good months here, so.
Yeah, actually, yeah. It gets really hot. So, JR yeah. and I actually met here in Bowling Green, Ohio, when you were going to school at BG.
Yep.
And we met through church, and JR is a previous guest of ours, Lucia's husband. So Lucia has been on the podcast already, and she's amazing as well. So I just love you guys. I love your family. I am so excited to be talking to you. I just wish you were right here in my living room again, but this is pretty good. And tell us a little bit about what you're doing in Dubai.
Yeah, sure. So after I finished up my studies at BG, I took a assistant professor post at Zai University, which is a government university in Dubai. And so I work right now specifically teaching design thinking and innovation and entrepreneurship to aspiring entrepreneur, female entrepreneurs here in Dubai. And it's one of the coolest gigs that I've ever had.
So
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. 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 I really consider this position much more than a teaching position. This is like I'm transforming the Middle East. You know what I mean? Like,
hell yeah.
With the work that we're doing is super fun. And it really is. It's changing mindsets about women in the Middle East. And
that's incredibly important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so I love it. Yeah.
I'm so proud of you guys because, I mean, I know wherever you go, you just do good things. But this does sound like it was especially made calling for you. So that is so cool.
Yeah. I have been initially coming, you know, we were kind of, oh, this is going to be so new. I'm not sure. And then I realized working with the students here are really similar to working with any underrepresented student. You gotta have a passion and love for what you do, and then the students do the rest, and they take it and they just run because they feel like you're invested in them and they want to perform. And so it's really, really cool. I love it.
You're facilitating what they really...
Yeah. This is their show.
Exactly.
I'm just on the side of the stage, so to speak, and just... watching them do their thing, and so it's fun.
So what were you doing recently? Like, you messaged me when you're on your way to some, like, it sounded extremely cool, like you were getting some award.
What was
that about? What did you receive that award for?
Yeah, so I've been doing some research on the topic about design thinking and innovation in the Middle East, and I just received an award for my work. Actually, that same day we had a design thinking competition where I worked with some female staff members. They were administrative staff and one faculty member actually, and they designed a study abroad program for their design project, and they won this competition, and they kicked the tails of all these faculty who've been doing this work for years and years. But it just goes to show, you know, you give people access to things and they really, really make it happen. It was really fun.
An opportunity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that was neat. And I was super proud to have worked with them. That the morning before it, they were just so grateful to be there. And I felt like just that gratitude. I said, guys, I felt like you're going to be rewarded for this gratitude. It might not be with the win, but not only did they win the competition, but now the university is actually implementing their project. I'm not on that end of the project anymore.
So cool. So it's actually like coming into practical.
Totally. Totally. Yeah.
Fruition. So they're gonna, that's amazing. Yeah. Cool, man.
Yeah, I love it.
I love that what you said about gratitude there, because that's been a real, like, a focus and a revelation to me recently. Just, you know, that it is like, it's an actual sort of metaphysical law.
Oh, absolutely.
That gratitude expands upon itself. And the more you're grateful in your present circumstances, it's added to. And, you know, you can experiment with that if you think that that's, you know, airy fairy woo woo nonsense.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just not,
exactly.
Even if you're not feeling it in your heart.
Yeah, exactly. My mom used to say, "Fake it till you make it."
It's like stunningly. It's like magical.
Yeah, it totally is. It's Lucia and I were in San Diego once, and this young girl, maybe 14 years old, she was up speaking at church, and she was like, "I have a testimony of karma." And Lucia and I kind of looked at each other like, "What is this girl talking about?"
But she's mixing
she was mixing the spiritual piece with this, like you were saying, this kind of metaphysical thing
with religion.
Yeah. But
I love that.
As I get older, I realize this is super true.
This is so true. Did anybody else giggle? Was it just over?
Of course. No. There are a lot of giggles in it. And I just remember, you know, when we left it, we were kind of giggling. But as the last few years, we're like, yeah, this is a thing.
It's a thing, man. I'm that girl because I've just come to understand just all of these threads of truth sort of not in the middle.
Oh, totally. Totally.
Isn't it cool?
Yeah, so, I love it.
I love that. Okay, so, but weirdly enough, and I'm like so stoked, I'm getting listening to what you're saying, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I have so many questions to ask afterwards. I want to talk to him about this. We need to collaborate. But yeah. That is not even why you approached me about the podcast today.
Nope.
You had something that you felt was so pressing that you would like to talk about. And I was like, oh, thank you so much for, like, this is so great. Tell us what it was. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah. I think I'll be honest with you. The last maybe year and a half or so, I've had some severe physical and mental health challenges. But interestingly enough, as I've been going through these things with experts and then with my family and sort of navigating these things, I've realized there are a lot of negative stigmas around mental health, and especially for Black men.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and so... as a Black male, of course, I'm not in the U.S. right now, but most of my life was spent in the U.S. And so as I sort of faced challenges, these mental health challenges especially, I just realized what the stigmas and the negative sort of perceptions I have about mental health. And I have to unpack these things in order for me to move forward, which I'm struggling with and trying to do and trying to be purposeful about this. But I really felt like this was an awesome month. This is Black History Month. And I felt like this is something that would be cool to kind of discuss, specifically with my experience with mental health and Black males and the things that I've experienced in my life. And just wanted to share my story with the hopes of, you know, helping others realize that there's help out there and there's love to be found in this process.
This is such, you know better than I do, obviously, but it is such an intensely important issue because, you know, I don't fraternize a lot with Black men. I'm in Bowling Green, Ohio. It's not exactly a massively diverse place, but I encounter a lot of males, and I know, you know, in my life, I have sons, they have friends, I have male friends, and I know how difficult it is for men to even acknowledge the need for help in their own lives. And then you've grown up in really sort of like gritty circumstances, it sounds like. I've only heard little kind of snippets here and there, but you grew up in... where did you grow up? Which part of New York?
So I grew up in... I was in Brownsville in Brooklyn. Yeah, so... I affectionately refer to myself as a project kid.
And so, and things, you know, you had a colorful little adolescence from, you know, the little pieces that you've told me. And, I can just imagine, you know, just when one or two things goes awry in those really formative years, just in the best of circumstances, it can take a long time to unravel.
For sure.
Even with, you know, I know that I'm pretty, when it comes to mental health, I'm pretty woke. Because of my own experiences and with my own children. And I look at how, you know, we're hyper aware of that stuff in our family because of my journey. And how hard it is just to be a young person and a young male, even in a family which is highly supportive and aware of mental health issues. And my sons have had a really kind of stable and mostly trouble-free existence in their little suburban neighborhood. And still, there are some significant and real challenges that they face. And I'm like, it takes my breath away how hard it must be for people who have grown up in not so easy and, you know, and sort of smooth circumstances. And then on top of that, there's a cultural stigma. It just all comes to this huge head which is exactly what you want. Always been so supportive of me, and you've never said the wrong thing. So you're really good at giving help.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. I really appreciate you saying that actually. But it's really interesting because obviously, you know, this giving help in whatever way we can for those who, you know, for our friends and family who might be struggling with some of these issues is completely different than when you're the one needing the help. Right. And so I felt comfortable, you know, being a friend, like I really felt comfortable with that. But the part I did not feel so comfortable with is reaching out to people, asking for a friend to help me navigate it. And my wife recognized that fairly early and was able to just grab my hand during this process. And then sort of she modeled what I needed in friendship. And so I was looking for those things for myself. So I was able to make some meaningful relationships with others because she really modeled kind of effective, positive mental health, you know, friendships around the mental health struggle. So it was so for me, I was lucky that way. But other people obviously don't have that.
So and, few people actually do. Yeah.
Sad. Yeah, it is sad. And it's not just the, oh, you know, go pray, go smile through the day, and you know, things will
Fake
work
it
out.
Till you make it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that only goes with karma. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, that doesn't work always, especially when you're dealing with severe anxiety and depression, right? Like,
for real.
The smiles are far between, and so you need strategies. You need spiritual development. You need identity development to sort of help you kind of navigate things. And so that's where I've been at sort of, and that's what sort of pushed me to the space right now that I'm in. And, you know, this is sort of, you know, identities are so salient when you're dealing with mental health. Yeah. Oh, like, you know what I mean?
That's what makes it so complex.
Yeah, exactly. Ugh. So I remember when I was studying, actually, even when I was a new professional in student services, I think I was working at University of Georgia at the time, and there was this Jones and McEwen, these professors, they had this identity development model where they essentially, like, depending on what stage a student is in or an adult is in, you know, identities are daily salient. So, you know, there may be identity around sexuality might be more salient than your cultural or racial identity, right? And then maybe the second year, it's more religiosity and spirituality, you know, so on and so forth. And so I'm realizing now, especially with when another transition that is huge for adults is when there are these mental and physical health challenges, then the identity of a father that I sort of was my salient identity for the last 10 years sort of took a back seat to this identity of more of somebody who needs this mental health and spiritual identity development. So these different, and so that was really strange for me because I was used to being kind of the dad, right? And
yeah,
so,
you're the man.
Exactly.
The man in charge.
Exactly.
You take care of everybody.
Exactly. Yeah, you take care of everybody until you're so depressed that all you want to do is sleep. And then that identity is thrown out the window because you're not in charge anymore, right? And so, and so I find, though, that it's more complicated because of my the cultural background that I'm from, right? And there is sort of this stigma that, you know, Black men, they are, you know, you got to watch out for them. They are shifty. They are thugs. All of these things that may seem sort of, because of media, may seem, oh, yeah, I've heard that. Yeah, I've heard that. But there's a lot of trauma that's with that as a Black male. And so then I start to question, well, was I ever really a good father? Was I ever really a good student? Did you know
lies.
What I mean? And the lies I tell myself because of this. And so that sort of brings
me to... And
those
lies are kind of like reinforced by...
By everything you hear, by what you see in social media.
Yeah.
So it makes this so much more complicated. And so this is why this cultural piece needs to be unpacked. And some of the lies that we even tell ourselves need to be sort of brought out as that truly lies and not reality. And that's kind of what I would love to kind of talk about a bit about, especially, for example, religion and mental health. There was, I just remember growing up, and kind of the commonplace joke at home is, oh, Jesus, take the wheel, right?
Yeah.
If I just give it over to Jesus, he's going to drive this vehicle for me, right? And so...
I shouldn't laugh. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just saw a meme in my head. So
but that's... Yeah, exactly. But this is the stuff that we heard as kids that are now, that's now memeified now. But this is the reality of it, right? And so when Jesus doesn't take over, when you go to him and you pray to him or whoever your God is, and you pray and it still doesn't go away, then what, Kirstie?
Then Jesus hates you.
Then
and
Jesus
what have you
hates
done
me.
Wrong?
And I'm a sinner. And it's because I'm a sinner that this is the case. And that is absolutely rubbish.
I know. I struggled incredibly hard with that as a woman a young mom
in
the Mormon church
and being like,
if I was more spiritual, just double down on the spirituality. So I get that.
Yeah, but my message is there's professionals out there who can help you navigate these issues, right? Like, if we seek out these professionals, they can help us navigate our spirituality, which is important to the history and to the culture of our people. So yes, let's maintain in the spirit of positive development, not in
and
this
use it as a positive tool, not punitive. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Not this sort of negative tool. And I think that for me is, or another thing we say, when we see a behavior that is going to cause trauma in the future, we just say, oh, he needs Jesus or she needs Jesus.
Yeah.
Like, she needs the cop, actually, because she ain't supposed to be hitting those kids like that. You know what I mean? Like, that's what she needs. And so
she don't need Jesus.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So these things we need to just be, we need to sort of hedge them off at the front, so to speak, and just say, no, let's just say what this is. This is trauma-inducing behavior, you know? Yeah. And so when, you know, the whole grandma, oh, that girl's behaving this way, acting like a boy and all this sort of stuff, this is transphobic, homophobic rubbish. And we need to say, no, she doesn't need Jesus. She needs somebody to say to her, you are hurting children by saying these negative things to them.
Yeah. Oh,
and
hard work.
Oh, of course. I mean,
to get people to like adjust. Yeah,
exactly. Well, because then, you know, the culture for once, you know, these sharecroppers move north.
Yeah.
The grandmother, Medea's, so to speak, they were in charge of the homes. And so their word was law. And so as a result, we have like this culture around anything the Medeas say or the grandmothers say, we have to accept this as law because that's how we were raised. And I value it's
literal gospel. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just kind of like, let's question what we're being told because we don't want to raise generations of people who don't have the critical thinking skills to navigate a complex society. So you don't have to push off your identity. You don't have to push off your spiritual identity. You don't have to push off your blackness. It's how do I inform those around me and my blackness and my spiritual identity to navigate in civility. And that is the key, I think.
Yeah, and it's kind of a sad thing, you know, because when, because then people might be sort of towing the line above, you know, in ways that people can see, but when they're feeling like, you know, okay, I've reached out for Jesus or you need Jesus for the mental health part and it's not working out, your relationship with the divine or the spirit or whatever it is that trust
of
is
course
broken is broken so you're not getting that. So people might be ostensibly still going to church and saying, well, you know, Jesus take the wheel and stuff, but what's happening is that they don't have any kind of legitimate spiritual connection because they feel rejected by it. They feel let down and there's no trust left. And so what people don't realize is when we force, you know, a solution in terms of spirituality and say that's the only one and it's not working out, it causes just that trust to erode. And it's when you use it as, okay, no, Jesus is there for you, but also so are meds and psychologists.
Exactly.
And stuff, so that Jesus can be a comfort to you, so that you can see that you're not bad or evil and this isn't your fault and these things. And then you can really restore that beautiful relationship with the higher power.
Yep.
So I think, I mean, it's only going to be helpful in the long run to what these Medeas kind of hoped for.
For sure.
Which is stay close to God.
Exactly. Which is amazing message, which is one that I value. And I think,
I do too.
Yeah, and I think you, and it's not even about a balance. It's a coexistence with this spiritual identity and allowing you to have mental peace and hope. And yeah. So I think you have to sort of work these things together. And I think, of course, what this is that in our culture, health professionals, medical professionals are authority people with authority.
Yeah.
And there's fear around authority. Right. And yeah. So. Yeah.
And well based fear. Really?
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And so if you go to those people, are you turning your back on your people? And so there is this issue that I've found, because I know for me, again, I want to mix my story into this, because I feel like that's important. Is so when I first started to figure out the physical health pieces and started to do some things my doctors actually do with eating better and exercising, and then of course taking my medicine and things like that, those things were not resolving the sadness and anxiety. And so it was because of the physical health piece that some of my fear around authority sort of was pushed back, right? Because I was kind of like, all right, so I have been to these professionals and they have helped me
kindly.
They were kind to me. They've helped me figure out things. And so it made it a little bit easier but it wasn't a lot easier. I'll be honest with you. I just remember going to the doctor after I'd had a horrible week of 2 weeks of depression. I mean, and anxiety. I could not sleep. I probably every day slept about 2 to 3 hours for about a month, but 2 weeks, it was just horrible. And all of the coping mechanisms that I had utilized before, because obviously anxiety and depression didn't just show up one day. I was dealing with this my whole life, but I had found ways to sort of navigate it, self-medicating.
The numbing behavior.
Exactly.
You didn't have access to
it. Yeah. Well, they didn't work.
Oh.
Yeah, they weren't working. And so I was just sort of like, oh my gosh, what is going on right now? And then what changed my mind and said I need to go get help is I had just known that I was having some type of aneurysm or heart attack. Something major was happening because my anxiety was so full tilt that I had these sort of heart palpitations, which is very common in anxiety, which I didn't know it was. So I went to my doctor and essentially said, man, check my heart, check my blood, because I'm about to have a stroke or a heart attack any minute now. And so I was totally comfortable because I knew he was going to sort me out, right? He was going to take my blood and he was going to say, this was high, and he's going to give me a pill. And then I got back the results and he essentially said, you're doing really well. From, the last time when you came in, these levels are down, these things are down. And so I just remember crying. He had just told me that I had the best health that I've been in years, but I just started crying because I was like, there's something wrong with me. Yeah. And so I called Lucia in a complete mess saying, he said, there's nothing wrong. This is in my head. I know it's in my head.
And that was like the worst news possible for you?
Exactly. It was horrible news because there was no fix from the doctor.
Right. Isn't that the worst?
Yeah.
That's the worst.
Yeah. And so I was just sort of like, all right, well, I don't want to live my life like I have for these last 2 weeks. No sleep. I didn't even interact with my kids much. I just wanted to come home and get in my bed. I had lost about 7 kgs because I literally could not eat. Yeah, it was just horrible. And I hated living life that way. And so that drove me to the psychologist, who then sent me to a psychiatrist. And I had a formal assessment by both professionals. One of the people that really has helped me here, she's from Boston. And so it's really cool. I was really lucky to find her. Her and I have a lot in common, so that was nice finding somebody, a mental health professional who I got on with was really nice. And she's from the Northeast, so there's just some things with sports and pace of life and things like that that we had in common, so we could talk about those things, you know, and it really kind of helped build this relationship of trust between the two of us.
Right.
And so when she suggested after visits, she was just kind of like, I really think you need to go see a psychologist because I think you need something to sort of take the edge off, so to speak. It's not the technical term, but I needed something to get me into a space where I could actually not sort of spiral out of control and just, you know, kind of go into this thing with anxiety and depression. What I was doing was, is I was just sort of talking myself in circles about these different things. And so,
this was the Boston woman was a psychologist.
To a psychiatrist.
Said it the other way around. And
sorry.
That's unusual, but I get it now.
Sorry about that.
Good. No, that's fine. That's so, you know, that's such a gift.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to access here. So I'm really glad you were there.
And so I got connected with the psychiatrist. And he did an assessment and he decided that I did need some low dosage of sort of an antidepressant because I was having some severe depression.
It allows you to sort of start doing the work.
It's exactly.
Like calms the brain down enough to say, okay, can you hear me now? Can you hear me? It's like almost a slap on the face to a hysterical person. to your nervous system. Like, okay, we're here now. But a lot of people think that that's the fix and then they don't do the part.
No.
That's just the slap in the face
that
part.
Is,
and
that
then
is.
They don't have the talk down and the tool getting. And that's, it has to be hand in hand.
It totally has to be. Yeah. And so now I have been utilizing this medicine and meeting with Carolyn, and so it's been really cool for me, like because you're right, that has sort of about 6 weeks after taking the medicine, I want to be clear that it wasn't a quick fix.
An agonizingly long time.
It really does.
If you're in hell.
Exactly. So it took a while. And
so with 6 weeks, did you start to feel better, kind of more stable after like 2 weeks, though, at least? Or
after 3 weeks? Yeah, after 3 weeks, I did feel a little better. But I definitely still felt on edge, so to speak. But 6 weeks, when I went in to meet with Carolyn, it was, I could hear her. You know what I mean?
You could hear her. Exactly.
Yeah, I could hear her.
It quiets the noise in the head so you can at least hear what she had to say.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talking about like, you know, like her and I just had an appointment. And one of the challenges that I have is I'm really hard on myself. And like a lot of academics are, right? This is not, you know, people frequently, you know, think, oh, you know, you get summers off, yada, yada, yada. But there's a lot of stress with being an academic, right?
Like, because it's not very well defined.
No, exactly.
And so then you're always questioning or comparing.
Am I good enough? And you go to these conferences and you meet these amazing people and you think, oh, and so then you get home and you just want to work so hard. And then you sort of develop bad habits as a result of not sleeping and, you know, just things like that.
I can see that could be the perfect storm for a person who is prone to doubting themselves.
Exactly.
Anything like that. Yeah. Or being hard on yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for me, just to sort of make that connection back to the culture piece, I felt like it was even more because as a Black male, and I'll be honest with you, Kirstie, I have to be better than everybody else. I can't just be as good because it's always this idea that, oh, it's because of, you know, they take it easy on the black guys or the black people don't have the same requirements because they have a quota that they need to meet at the university, even though it's absolute trash rubbish. But this is what the media spews with quotas.
Well, even Michelle Obama talked about that a lot in her book.
Yeah. Yeah.
She was like, everybody would be like, oh, yeah. Okay. Well, she had it even in her mind, even if people weren't.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to really prove my place here.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's added pressure. And so, And so it, and a lot of this, you know, of course, has to do with being a person of color in the United States education system. And it is systematic oppression. And it's still. And people don't realize that. But I'm dealing with the mental trauma around that system there that promotes what I can only, you know, refer to as oppression. It is through and through. And why I feel that way is because if you don't believe the way, you know, common thoughts, you know, or thought authorities on different topics, then you're kind of looked at, especially in academia, you looked at, oh, that's the weirdo. Or, yeah, of course they have this agenda because they're black and they only care about black people. They don't care about white people. In education, especially, we get black Americans and Africans, actually, who do work research with people of color, specifically with black people. There's like this belief that, oh, if your research is about low income or children or adult learners of color, then it's like, oh yeah, well, is that real research? Because they're only doing research on the minority, it's not the majority. And so there's a lot of trauma and a lot of imposter syndrome, right? You feel like,
I was about to say, the imposter syndrome is just like ratcheted up like 60,000 notches.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely.
Because of the feedback. That's horrible.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And so then there's this thing that a lot of people don't account for is racial battle fatigue.
Oh, yeah.
And that is, I just get sick of having to fight administrators. And that was, you know, that really was one of the reasons I was excited to get out of the United States context when it came to education, was because it's just, you fight administrators who are raised in this racist sort of way of understanding. And then you have to justify your existence in every turn. And then when you justify your existence, you get the nasty comments about, oh, this person is a quota hire. This person, you know what I mean? And it gets tiring and it brings on depression and anxiety because of this sort of, because of the structure that is around the education system.
As if it's not hard enough just to live do that work. As if it's not enough pressure just to do the stuff. Then to have to justify doing the stuff. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, of course, it's going to start to wear on you. But then, of course, but if you had had trauma from before, which you probably did.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you want to talk about that, but just like having to deal with all of that's a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, Kirstie, it's not so much. I will say the faculty and staff at BG, although I, you and I both know racism is alive and well in Bowling Green, Ohio. I will say that in my academic unit, it was a fairly diverse unit in a lot of different ways. And so for me, some of the racism, for example, in BG, I didn't have to experience like some of the undergrads might have had, because I had secured funding for the whole time that I was there. And so some of the, I didn't have to constantly justify my existence and why I wanted to do research on people of color who were studying at the university. I didn't have to justify that because I had the funding. But I know a lot of colleagues who had to fight every single academic year to get funding. And so if we want to talk about ways to help people of color avoid imposter syndrome and these mental health issues in higher education, one way is by allowing folks to do the work they love to do and actually pay them to do it.
Yeah.
So that's one way we could do that. Anyways, and so, but in my personal life, there were things that I experienced. I just remember one night, I like you mentioned earlier, I have kids. And so we had all four of our kids in BG while I was doing my doctoral work. And so it made for challenging days. Like during the day, it wasn't like I could just be a full-time student and not be a dad, right? Because there were still diapers that needed to be changed and school pick up and drop off. And I have an amazing partner that sort of took the brunt of that on. So I'm not suggesting that I had to do that, but I obviously had to do my part. And so
she was dealing with significant health challenges.
Exactly.
Significant health challenges.
Yeah, for sure.
You did not have an easy road.
No, I didn't. And, but so that meant the daytime was really spent on with my family and the kids. Yeah. And so the only time that I really could really focus on my studies was, after the kids went to bed, I would go to campus probably about 9 o'clock and stay there to about 2 o'clock, 1 to 2 o'clock in the morning. And then I'll walk home and sort of get up to do the drop off or pick up whatever I had to do the next day. But many a night coming home from campus to walk to my, walk to the rental, which is about maybe 5 blocks from campus. I had some very sort of tricky, scary evenings. I remember this is how racism works in the U.S. It starts to make you as a person of color think you're a bad guy. So I'm walking down the street and I see this white lady, young white, you can tell she's probably an undergrad, walking home from Main Street, which is where all the pubs are. And so I didn't know what state she was in. So I was walking down the side of the road, listening to my music, not really paying attention. But then as soon as I look up and saw her, Kirstie, my heart started beating. And this little girl is just walking home, but my heart started beating fast. And I thought, how can I get out of her way to make sure she's scared of me? So I walk into the street in Bowling Green, Ohio, in the winter, slush and snow on the road. And I walk into the street just so that I have to avoid her. So I literally put my life in danger because oncoming cars can't see me walking down the street and there's slush in the road. So they won't be able to stop, but I just book it into the street. And so just so that I don't scare her.
Oh my hell.
And so this is the trauma. This is the issues that a black male has to deal with, a side of the story that a lot of people don't know. We get those same messages from the media. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
We're not exempt from those messages. And so even though they don't affect us the same way, they're not as, but they still are scare tactics. And to this day, I will say things to Lucia like, oh, you should go into this shop or do this in the evening because I don't want to scare those folks.
Oh, my hell.
And so I know that might seem extreme, but this is true to life. This is my experience.
Well, I don't think it seems extreme when we look at just examples of how things go down.
Yeah,
for black men,
exactly,
versus how they go down for white men. We don't see white men being shot in the back
or choked out by police officers until they die
for a traffic stop.
Yeah,
this doesn't actually happen. And I better not even get started. Okay.
Yeah, no.
I'll let you speak on this.
Yeah.
As much as you like.
No. So I guess that experience was to share was, this is the baggage that Black males have to carry. And this is not healthy, obviously.
No, it's not.
And so when there's a stigma around getting help and then a stigma around authority and help, we see why we're six times more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia and these different more extreme sort of mental health issues, because these things are not being addressed at the basic, the foundational level. And when I say foundation, the country is built on these bigoted practices and approaches to men of color, especially Black men. And so until we address those things, we're going to have these struggles with Black men and mental health, because we are being attacked emotionally and physically and mentally.
So you said at the beginning, something I wanted to go back to, where you're like, there's such a mistrust of authority that you actually, the men have to deal with the idea that they're selling out their people by even going to authority and asking for help.
Yep.
That's a thing. That's a, like, you went to the man. Is that how it is?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I think the issue really is loose lips sink ships is one of the things that I heard. So if you go and talk about this trauma, you are sinking the Black ship or the culture. You're not doing it for the culture. Right. Because now you're telling these professionals about the problems and the tragedies in our community. And it's
reinforcing what they thought or what?
Yeah, it's reinforcing what they thought, or you're giving them insights to exploit us even more.
Oh, yeah. So and it's so, like, do not speak to the white man under any circumstances about anything that's going on inside of our heads
in our community. Because they're not, that can be used as strategies against, and that's going to end up on the media saying, you see, these people are naturally violent. These people are naturally depressed. These people are naturally, so it feeds into these stereotypes that white America has of us. And so
anything we say can and will be used against us.
Yeah, totally.
In the court of public opinion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, horrible.
Yeah, so and you don't want to be the one. Either. Yeah, for sure. You don't want to be the one to sink the ship, right? And so you don't want to go to the authorities. And you know what? We don't even have time to talk about access issues, right? Like,
well, that's what
first of all, we
to
don't
mention.
Yeah, the big
someone.
But you know that topic has been kind of talked about. Yeah, and America will be held accountable for not having access for Americans to mental and physical health. And I mean,
America is being held accountable right now.
Yeah, for sure. So that has been talked about, and it still needs to be spoken about, but for me, one of the big things is trust of authority that we don't talk about as much, because there is this perception that you're giving fodder to the fire when you go to get help. And we have to think about this way. Okay. I am getting help for my development, for my own personal development. And I was thinking about this thing that is now sort of a popularized thing, is living your best life. Like, you go get help so that you can live your best life. So that's why you get help.
Why else would it be?
Yeah. So I think if we think about it in context of, like, listen, you living your best life will help the community. That's what I say.
That's
right?
Exactly
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
so,
exactly it. And yeah. I think when men have problems with, you know, the idea of this masculinity is threatened by asking for help.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, to me, and I am not saying this to, you know, stroke male egos or to get people to get help at all.
Yeah.
I genuinely see a guy who will look at himself and be and do that most incredibly brave work of being vulnerable and saying, yeah. I need help. I see that as the height of masculinity, of true masculinity, saying, I need help so that I can be a better father, a better husband, a better contributor to my community. And I'm willing to do the incredibly courageous work of being vulnerable enough to say, listen, something in here is not working out, and I'm going to need everything you got so that I can get fixed and get back to work.
Exactly. Exactly. I need to get back to that community that I love and want to protect. And the way that I do that is I get help for myself.
Yeah,
and then I can get to the work for
and I just
for
see
us.
That as just so flippin' responsible. I see that as yeah. so grown up. I see that as the man.
Yeah,
and I do not speak for every other woman, but when I say that to guys, they look at me in such a skeptical way. Like, sure, that's your party line, good one, nice. And I'm like, truly, I know, I think it's maybe because I have been through the process and I know the amount of courage that it takes to face your demons and then to admit to them and speak them. And then I project that onto what it must be like for a guy with the cultural stuff. But I didn't even think about with all the black stuff because I wasn't even aware of that. I wasn't aware of this fear of authority in terms of even a doctor.
Yeah.
Or a psychologist. And that's profound. That is a lot.
And so this brings up, I hope we can see how this is systematic now, right? Like when we can be exploited on all these different levels, it happens so thoughtlessly in society. That means there's a system set up. And maybe the system is not organized, but it's there, and I believe it's organized. But some people will argue, absolutely. I believe,
it was
exactly
what, not very old, so we can look back without very much difficulty at all,
for sure. And so, you know, that's an important thing, but I think even more importantly for folks who are listening is getting help is helping the community.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
Because then we're going to be better for our people. We're going to be better for our kids. We're going to be better for the church. We're going to be better for the government to help with community development. We're going to be better for each other.
Of course.
And so that's why this is individual development is good for the whole. And I think America is sort of, in a lot of ways, because of the current race climate and economic climate, there's sort of this unique and you know, maybe the whole is not as important, but I think when we do help ourselves, it allows us to have a space to help others.
And, have you found that the things that you learn in therapy or about yourself and whatever, that you've immediately been able to implement them in helping other people?
Oh, absolutely.
Like,
absolutely.
Instantly.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
absolutely.
Like same day
for
kind
sure.
of thing. It's
totally.
Because our wounds are similar. Like we, you know, no matter how they got there, there are similar themes. And the minute you start to understand yourself just that tiny bit better, you can carry that piece of information, you can carry that healing to your people or people you don't even know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost instantaneous. Yeah. I just think it's like the payoff is immediate, I find.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're finding it because you've got such a gift for kind of connecting to people and, you know, this natural rapport with pretty much anybody you encounter. Well, don't you think? I mean, you do. And now that you've got these kind of extra layers of awareness, I just think that's like profoundly helpful.
Yeah.
And raising kids, I just look back and think, holy crap, what if I tried to raise teenagers without getting therapy?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, what would that have looked like? And I use it every single day.
Totally.
Multiple times a day.
Yeah.
So,
and it's not just for me as an educator, it's not just with my kids, you know, my biological children, but those women that I so profoundly love to serve, I'm utilizing these things to help them. And so now they're going to be better for the UAE and the Middle East, and they're going to help improve the Middle East. And there's going to be sort of a mental health sort of awakening in the region as well, which is needed, to be honest with you. And so all of this sort of stuff plays into one another. And that really kind of leads me to, like, really the last thing I wanted to say was, like, I really feel like there is this perception that if I avoid it, it's going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to go away. And no, I found the exact opposite to be true. Like, I have to talk about it, and I hate talking about it. I want to be clear. I don't like talking about it because of the culture that I've raised around that's putting your business in the streets. One way that has been said, like, when you start telling people things about yourself. But I find it's therapeutic to sort of share this journey that I'm on, because it's not going to go away. It is going to be there until we unpack it. Now, that unpacking takes a long time. For some people, it's going to require medicine. Some people, it won't. Some people, it require weekly appointments with a psychologist. Some people, it won't. It looks differently. But the key is finding people to help you navigate the journey, and then fighting to stay on that path, because that's the only way the trauma is going to subside.
People will say, I don't have trauma, I'm fine.
Yeah.
I'm this, I'm that. And the thing is, you might be telling yourself that, but your body, the body doesn't lie.
There's
a book that says the body keeps the score.
It does keep the score.
And the health issues that crop up from it not being addressed, or the fact that you're like, you're wondering, how come is it that I have sort of this exaggerated negative response to things that other people seem to just be fine with, and the hiding of that. And they're like, I don't feel like I'm normal around these issues that other people seem to sort of, you know, like skate through. All of those things, it will happen. And I had a psychologist, when I was resisting getting help, say to me, trauma will inform your life every single day of your life until you look at it. It
will
control your life in one way or another. And you can tell yourself the lies that you're fine and that it's not, but it is.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. There's just no avoiding it. So be a man up. And face it, you know, or woman up and face it. And that's what I say. It's like, we've got to take away this. It's not masculine, or it's not.
Yeah.
It's not leadership. You know, it's a strong leader shows no cracks. It's like, oh, no, a strong leader goes, oh, I'm cracked everywhere. Let me go and get those filled.
With the good team members, the good people out there who know how to navigate this. To me, that's a good leader. They recognize the strength of others, and then they are allowed to grow from other strengths. And I love what you just said. The trauma is not going to leave. It's not going to go away just because you decide that you're going to sleep through the day, or eat through the day, or drink through the day, or smoke through the day.
Yeah,
it is
all of the numbing behaviors, or play video games through
or
have sex through the day,
or have whatever it is, or social media yourself to death. It will not take it away, and until it's being addressed. And I think in my experience, in my Black community where I was raised, all of these sort of numbing practices, they, even though they're changing, they are still alive and well, and
sometimes celebrated, aren't they? Yeah. They're kind of celebrated, absolutely, as having arrived. If I've got hookers and blow, and this is for all men, not just black men.
Yeah,
like once I've made a bunch of money and I've got a bunch of money for doing whatever I want, buying whatever I want as a numbing thing, you know. All the booze, all the drugs, all the hookers, all the this, all the that, all the cars, all the this, I'll be fine. And that's just like, no, those are not markers of success.
Nope.
You need all those things for peace and happiness, and you can't sit quietly with yourself. And I think that's the thing. If you have the ability to sit quietly with yourself with nothing else going on and feel all right, then you're probably okay.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that ability and you have to reach for this or this or that on a daily, you got to look and go, okay, something's got to be addressed. And that's the thing, you know, these numbing things, these numbing agents are celebrated as markers of success. And I don't know, does that resonate with you when you know, if you can't sit quietly with yourself? Because that's, to me, that's my sign that I'm out of alignment. If I cannot sit quietly and peacefully with myself in the mundane.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's for sure. Like, that definitely is one of the milestones. Another thing is if I can't have a interaction with my partner that isn't sort of stress inducing or a negative interaction, for me, that is another marker for me where I'm like, oh, there's something going on, because the person that I made a choice to navigate this world with is stressed by me, or I'm stressing her. Then I'm like, oh, well, okay, what's going on here?
Or if everybody in the world is in the wrong.
Yes.
And they're making you angry. Like, what the hell is wrong with everybody?
What's the matter with these people?
When you start saying what the hell, literally everybody, the common denominator might be a little bit of work here.
Yes.
But there are lots of sort of, so what would you, if you had the opportunity, and I know this is kind of a platform, you know, but if you had like the opportunity to go out and make sure that you were heard by every single man in your community who was struggling with what you've struggled with.
Yeah.
What would you say to them today? What would you be like, my most heartfelt wish is that you will do this, or you'll understand this. Like, what is that, you know?
Yeah.
What would you want to say?
I would say being mentally and physically healthy is so that you can do you. That's the goal of everybody, right? They want to do them. They want to live their best lives. They want to have the value that they want. And so the way you do that in a productive way is by making sure you maintain or create an environment where you can have solid mental health. And so for the brothers that are listening, if you don't have that peace in the mundane, if you don't have that peace with family and friends, and the trauma of living weighs you down, go get help so that you can work toward finding that peace and joy in life. That's what I say. I know a lot of us have a dedication to the community, but we can't help the community when we can't help ourselves. And
we
so,
really
yeah, because the village needs you. The village absolutely needs you. Other black males need you to be healthy. And so go get that help so that you can come back and be a part of raising these black males in this village.
the physician heal thyself is so important. And I think another numbing behavior people need to be aware of is sometimes projecting, like, I need to heal the world. I need to heal all these injustices. I need to heal that, because they've got a huge gap in themselves. And the best way to do any of that work is to start with yourself. And then everybody you encounter in your family. You know, because a lot of people go out there and try to, you know, fix every single thing that's wrong where there's lots of trouble at home. Because it seems easier and you don't have to face that really most terrifying demon, which is inside of you.
Totally. Yeah. But you, you face that demon when you seek help from folks who know how to help you, right?
And it's never as scary as you imagine it would
be. No, no.
It's only the scary in theory.
Yeah.
But in practice, it's so much less scary to face it than imagining facing it. I promise that. That is true.
And you know, it's the work is hard as well, right? Like,
And that's another. Sometimes.
Yeah,
it is boring. And it's not a quick fix.
Yeah, it's not quick. So, and I think a lot of people are aware of that. But anything good, obviously, we know the adage, anything good, it takes a bit. It takes some work at it. So we, Lucy and I were listening to a book called Outliers. I don't know if you've heard of this book.
Malcolm Gladwell?
Yeah. And so one of the things he talks about is the 10,000 hour rule.
Yeah.
Like if you spend 10,000 hours on something, you become an expert, right?
Right.
And so, you know, I think about all the time that I spend developing lessons, all the lectures I've given, all these things. And so I'm not sure that I'm at 10,000 hours yet, but I feel more comfortable in my skin in that space. But that's because I've spent the time in that space to feel comfortable. So I think this same principle can be applied to mental health, right? Like we need to spend 10,000 hours on trying to figure out how we can sort ourselves out, and I think we might be more comfortable in that space of mental health development, right? If we're spending more time
as a job.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And you know, people sometimes will say to me, well, you know, what have you been doing the last few years? And I'll say, well, about for the last 5 years, my full-time job has been healing.
Perfect.
And it has been a full-time job, and I have to fight constantly against myself when I do things where I'm like, well, that seems self-indulgent. And I'm like, but is it though? Really?
Yeah.
Isn't self-indulgent to go to yoga, to learn how to meditate or to exercise and to do anything?
Yeah.
When at the end of the day, it's allowing me to be strong and wise for my children and their children and the people in my community. I don't think so. It's probably worth a degree in Kirsty, you know,
healing.
But the thing is, but I'm really in tune with that. And I still fight desperately against the voices in my head going, oh my gosh, the navel gazing or whatever, you know, this is not the best use of your time, this seems self-indulgent and all that stuff. This is very white woman privilege. And that's the thing, you know, recognizing that I do have the privilege to have that kind of lifestyle.
Totally.
Means that I need to give back
that
much extra. So if you have play whatever game with your head that you have to play initially until you understand how important it is, and just be like, okay, I'm investing in the community or I'm investing in my family, and that's actually not a game, that is or would I do this for my kid? I do this for the you know, and you cannot heal and save your kid if your own inner child is a mess. And I don't know if that's going to alienate people, so maybe I'll just be quiet at this point. But
no. But I, you know, for me, it's the how we say you do it for yourself and do it for the hood, or do it for the people, right? Or do it for the culture, whatever you need to say to get yourself to say, I need to go talk to somebody. Do it for the hood, then do it for it.
I mean, if you had a gunshot wound, what would you do?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, how helpful are you to the hood when you're getting out? Like, what would you do? How would why are we this way? And, you know, back to how you were like, well, I'm having a heart attack and on my hustle to the doctor. Like, no questions asked. I'm all about it. And then he's like, no, you're fine. And you're like, oh, no.
What the heck is going on right now?
Why are we so averse to taking that same injury? That's and it's just debilitating.
Totally.
You were going home and going to bed and losing weight. Or you know, because you couldn't eat and not sleeping. Yeah. Yeah. It is just as debilitating. It really is. And actually more so in some ways, because when we lash out at our families out of pain and mental illness, they don't see that. Nope. They don't see the gunshot wound, or they don't see the traumatic brain injury, or whatever it is. They don't see what's going on in our soul. And they internalize that as there's something wrong with me. And you don't want your pain to be manifested in your kids or your loved ones or your community by thinking there's something wrong with them, because they can't see that you're actually operating from a very, very injured place.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the other really important part to remember, that you will, your pain will manifest onto other people, and they won't know it's your pain. They'll take it on as their own. And don't let that happen to your kids.
Exactly. Yeah. And then that becomes their trauma.
Which we don't want.
This is how, and we don't want them to have that trauma. We don't want our kids. We don't want our community to have that trauma. We don't want our churches to have that trauma. The things we love, we don't want to have that. So how do we make sure that doesn't happen? We have to get help so that it doesn't trickle down to the people.
So with that heartfelt plea, you know, do it for yourself and everybody you love, you don't even know but love. This is important work, and you're so courageous. You know, I say, like I've said, you know, I'm a white woman, and speaking from all of that privilege, I know how hard it is, and it's so much sort of more societally acceptable for me to speak about it, and it's still hard, and it still takes gumption. So I can really applaud you for this tremendous amount of courage and selflessness in being not only willing to talk about it, but volunteering to talk about it. I think that you've done an incredible service, and I really give you so many props for that. My estimation of you, I didn't think could be higher, but it is.
Cheers. So
truly, thank you so much. And I just hope that, I just know, JR, that you have been such an inspiration to my sons without even trying to. You have a way of connecting to people where they can tell that you genuinely care. And I really want to thank you for that, because you have comforted and mentored so many young men that you are not even aware of, that they are just really, truly in awe of you and love you. And I think it's just because you show you care. And it helps that you're cool, but you genuinely show that you care. And I think that, you know, anybody listening to this and who feels like they want to take a step towards this, but they don't quite know how, I'm sure that JR would be willing to talk to you.
Absolutely.
I don't want to speak to you, but you've never let anybody I know down. So, you know, they can, I'm sure they can reach out to you. How do you want people to reach out to you?
So I'm on Facebook, J.R. Ratliff. J.R. is the first name, Ratliff, R-A-T-L-I-F-F.
Cool, and they can also just message you?
Just message me, or jasonratliff.fam@gmail.com. You could hit me up on the email there, and I'd be more than willing to chat. Yeah, if you genuinely want to pursue sort of getting help, we can get you connected to resources so that we can help.
That is such a service. Thank you so much for being willing to do this. I feel very honored that you would do it on my platform, and I hope that this allows you to you know, now that you've done that, that you make use of whatever other platforms you have, and that other men do the same, and that you start a real movement regarding this, because it's probably the most important thing that you can do for your community at this point. So, or one of them. So thank you.
You're welcome, friend.